Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to our meeting of worship and remembrance here this morning. James, of course, is going to be giving us the word of exhortation, and he's drawing upon Judges. And, of course, that's where our first portion of the Old Testament readings are drawn from. Our brother James's thoughts are drawn from Judges 17 and also from chapter 18 and at verse 1. And, in fact, his theme is, "In those days."
Well, a very good morning, brothers and sisters. So, as our brother Kent has intimated, this morning we're going to have a look at Judges chapter 17. And what we hope to learn about this story, which will lead us to the emblems, these really critical symbols for us of the Lord Jesus Christ's body and his blood, are these. Number one, superstition is no substitute for knowing God. Number two, our religion is not God's religion. Number three, religion that looks close can be way off. And finally, relying on others to create our relationship with God is misguided. So you'll see these ideas interwoven in this story. Now, there are three characters that we're introduced to in Judges 17. So the first is Micah. The second is a freelancing Levite from Bethlehem, Judah. There's two Bethlehems, one in Zebulun, but this is Bethlehem, Judah. And just for the purposes of our exhort this morning, we shall call him Jonathan. And then we are introduced to Micah's mum. So the scene of this story is in the mountains of Ephraim. This is an area that was mountainous, pretty fertile. Jeremiah talks about there being plenty of water, and it was more of a precinct or a district as opposed to a particular mountain. Later on, it became pretty well known as Samaria, but it's sort of north of Bethel, around the plain of Jezreel. Well, what about the vibe of the place? What's the vibe that's going on here in Judges chapter 17? Well, we pick it up in verse 6 and chapter 18, verse 1, and then 19, verse 1, and 21, verse 24. Everyone did everything they wanted. Let's have a quick look at 2 Timothy chapter 3. So let's think about that concept in light of what Paul predicts will be the situation in the last days. In the last days, perilous times will come. Men shall be lovers of their own selves. And then there's a long list of traits that are common to all mankind. Let's head down then to verse 4. These people are traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, a resemblance of godliness, but denying God's power. See, the situation that was culturally extant in the period of the Judges is the same culture that we are challenged with now. And because that's what's happening in society today, it can't but help, well, this situation in our ecclesias, it can't but help be reflected in our worship, in our gatherings together. So if we think about some of the changes that have occurred in ecclesial life in the last 5, 10 or 20 years, these things are pretty much a reflection of society. And if society is focused on themselves, then we need to take strong precautions that that doesn't happen in ecclesial life. So Micah. Micah's name means "who is like Yahweh." It's got a really unusual pronunciation. It's like something like Mikahu or something like that. And as this story unfolds, really weirdly, in Hebrew, so does his name. But it's not obvious to us because we just read the name Micah. And Micah is middle-aged. He has a large family that were old enough to lead worship. And it would appear that The story that we're reading in Judges 17 and then 18, 19 and 21 aren't in chronological order. This isn't an unveiling of the history of Israel during the time of Judges. These stories actually commence at the end of Joshua and are at the beginning of the book of Judges. So we're then introduced to the wandering minstrel from Bethlehem. Bethlehem, of course, was the home of David, Boaz and Ruth, Jesse, Salmon and Rahab. Now, he was a Levite. There was 48 Levitical cities, and Bethlehem was not one of them. So what was a Levite doing in Bethlehem? Well, more than likely, his mother was from Judah, and that's where the family home was. So it's curious to think about this, that this Levite, Jonathan, who we'll call him, is a contemporary of Boaz. We know a bit about him. He's young. He's extremely ambitious. He was in search of fame and fortune. And perhaps with a little embellishment to his resume, without any reference checks, he scores his dream job in the middle of Israel, in the mountain of Ephraim. And you know, I can't really blame him for embellishing his resume. This job came with all sorts of amazing perks, and who hasn't done a little bit of embellishment on a resume to land a dream job? Well, he's offered quite a salary, 10 pieces of silver. So Graham's now thinking, every resume I get is embellished. So yes, Graham knows that's true. All right, let's have a look at the coin. Okay, let's cut to the economics of it all. He's offered 10 amazing pieces of silver. So how does that translate? He wasn't just going to accept any job for any money. And so if the average income of an Australian person in November 2021 was $1,783 a week, did he get that? No, because that's the average. The average male income is closer to $2,000 a week. So if we annualise that over 12 months, he was probably getting a salary in the order of $125,000. But his job just didn't come with the money, did it? He was also to get his meals provided. So in banking, we use an index to determine how much people spend on their food and their drinks, and that's about $25,000 a year. So now his salary's gone up to $150,000. He doesn't get superannuation, but he does get a uniform. So we take into account a clothing allowance, and he gets lodging. So when we put it all together, his annual income really represented close to $175,000. Now, the final character in this story is Mrs. Micah, and she's a tough old bird. Now, what do we know about this elderly grandma? Well, she probably had been born in Egypt, which meant that she was quite familiar with the icons and the idolatry that was prevailing in Egypt at the time. During her wandering in the desert, she would have given birth to Micah, and perhaps Micah then married and his children were born. Now, she had amassed not a small but a large fortune, 1,100 pieces of silver. 1,100. So not 1,000, not 1,200. She liked to count her pieces of silver like an old dragon. 1,100 pieces of silver. So later on in Judges, we're reminded that the five Philistine lords offered Delilah 1,100 pieces of silver each, or 5,500 pieces of silver, to encourage her to seduce Samson. How much is 1,100 pieces of silver in today's money? Well, if 10 pieces of silver equals $175,000, if we multiply that 10 pieces by 110, her net worth was somewhere between $12 million and $14 million. Now, there's no husband in the story, but if we have a look at, I think it's about Joshua chapter 20, verse 28 or verse 8 or thereabouts, it describes how some tribes were told to go home and take all of their loot with them. And so I wonder whether this was the gains of the territorial victories of the Ephraimites. Anyway, verse 3 of Judges chapter 17. And when he had restored the 1,100 shekels of silver to his mother said, I have wholly dedicated the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son. Now, this feisty old smog goes into meltdown, swearing and cursing that we read about in verse 2 because someone had pilfered her purse and slunk off with the silver. I wonder how securely she stored it. My guess it was probably hidden under the mattress, but some klepto had crept in and kept her coins. Now, whether Micah heard this ranting and raving through the thick walls of his mansion or whether he heard them out in the garden, we're not quite sure, but one thing we know is he heard it and the colourful curse took its effect. Now, Micah knew how to tame a dragon, and he returns the money. The moral turpitude was rescinded with a contrite confession. Hand on heart, he says, Mummy, it was me. So we read in verse 3 that Micah's mum's quite ecstatic with this. Oh, she says, oh, blessed be thou, Yahweh, what a wonderful, wonderful boy. Now, he wasn't. And this is some of the things that we'll read in Judges chapter 17, 18 and 19. The back, the front, topsy-turvy world, the misguided consciences, the right being wrong and the wrong being right. Judges 17 through to 21 is a story of depraved human nature. Now, I wonder if I had stolen between $12 and $14 million from my dad, how that would have gone down for me. Is that how I would have responded? If I'd stolen the money, been guilted into returning it, whether my dad would say, oh, James, you're just a wonderful, wonderful boy. Well, this money was to fund her retirement, but she was quite old, so that meant that Micah was going to get it in a little while anyway. But he was trapped by the trappings of wealth. The temptation for Micah was too much. He saw the money and opportunistically stole it and took his inheritance early. So this response she gives, I think you'd agree, is just a bit off. So not only does Micah avoid any consequences, as we read, she then donates $3 million to his cause of idolatry. So I think, parents, this is something for us to think about. If our children lie or steal or do something we shouldn't, we are obliged to call it out. And if we don't, we're as good as blessing them. But the language in the King James Version in particular is a bit confusing. So let's just try to work out what's happened here. See, verse 3, and when he had restored the 1,100 shekels, so that's the first line, and then the last line of verse 3, now therefore I will restore it unto thee, and verse 4, yet he restored the money. So I think the King James is blurring the way that this conversation naturally would have flowed. I think it went more a bit like this. He's saying to his mum, and thou didst utter a curse and did also say in my ears, I verily dedicate the silver unto the Lord from my hand for my son to make a graven image. Behold, the silver is with me, he says to her, I took it, now therefore I will restore it unto you. And his mother said, blessed be thou of Yahweh. So when the mother of Micah discovers that the money had been stolen, which I reckon she would have known pretty quickly, like most dragons, she curses this thief, never dreaming, never imagining that the thief would have been her wonderful, wonderful boy. But what she does is she augments this curse with a solemn, consecrating vow. This money is no longer mine. This money is Yahweh's. So this is what I think made Micah panic, because if it's Yahweh's goods, the story of Achan is only a couple of years old. He understood what happened to Achan and to his children. Now, what she did actually is invoke this vow law that is recorded in Leviticus chapter 5. So, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Let's have a quick look at that. Leviticus 5, verse 1. And if a soul sin and hear the voice of swearing and is a witness, whether he has seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity. Okay, so if you're in the ear of someone that is swearing that money is dedicated to God, and you know about it and you say nothing, then you become an accomplice to the crime. So this is why Micah, in my view, is really quick to return the money. But Micah's mum has a problem. Because he's stolen it, he's committed the crime, okay? So he's guilty. He's been cursed. So how does a witch overcome a curse? Well, you negate a curse with a blessing, don't you? So I don't know whether she really thought that her son was a wonderful boy for stealing the money, but because she loved her son, mollycoddled her son, didn't call her son out ever, in their superstitious way, they've offset the curse with this blessing. Now, Micah happily picks up all of the silver and goes and visits a foundry. So we read in the end of verse 4, and picks up these 200 pieces, gave it to the founder, who made a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. So what strikes me as being a bit odd is how soon after the people were in Israel, that businesses had been established to melt down silver to create idols. Like, it didn't seem that Micah had to wander around in the dark and skulk around. He could just pretty much walk in the middle of the day to the local silversmith, and Bob's your uncle. He was able to produce a graven image. Explicitly against the second commandment. Again, something that's pretty obviously wrong. So why does it talk about two different types of idols, a graven image and a molten image? There's various guesses, and I'm not sure why, because I wasn't there. But anyway, he picks up a couple of extra items for what appears to be a temple or a small shrine. In verse 5, the man Micah had a house of gods. So what are these idols all about, really? Well, man wants to make God in his image. But I can't carve my own image of God and assume it is the God of the Bible. If I'm trying to suit God to myself and to my circumstances and to me, then I'm perhaps losing sight of who Yahweh is. And so does Micah. And that's why in verse 5 his name has changed. So check a concordance. In Hebrew, the Yahweh bit of his name drops off. So instead of the question being, who is like unto Yahweh, it is, who is like... It's a resemblance. Looks close, doesn't it? You know, this worship that we read about in verse 5, we have a shrine, we have an ephod, a teraphim, we've even got a consecrated priest. We have all of the trappings of something that looks like genuine tabernacle worship. But God reveals what he thinks about it by redacting his name from the work of this superstitious warlock. His mini temple was full of gods. Now, an ephod's quite a particular piece of equipment, isn't it? Like, it was something that was imitating the tabernacle worship. It was a specific garment to a priest. And why not? He's ordained his son as a priest, so may as well make him look like one. But what we're learning here is that idolatry is strangely bewitching. And not only had Micah fallen under its spell, but so had his mum, and so had at least one of his sons. What motivates Micah to clone true religion, to have something that resembles what God expects? Well, it was all about Micah and it wasn't about God. This was man-oriented, man-originated, man-centred, man-made religion. And as we learn about Micah in this and the next chapter, it is all about self-interest and it is all about finance. So the warning that we have from 2 Timothy chapter 3 is that our hearts are desperately wicked. Our hearts are naturally depraved. Everyone was doing that which was right in their own eyes. And Micah's religion was all about what he could get out of it. So isn't it time, brothers and sisters, this morning, just to gently and quietly reflect and ask ourselves, well, what am I giving God? What am I giving to my brothers and sisters? And where is our true place of worship? Is it here? Is it in our hearts? Is it in our minds? Is it a manufactured worship at home, like Micah was trying to do? Well, there are times when perhaps all of those ideas are the right place of worship. Everyone did that which was right in their own eyes. So this radical individualism was the hallmark of the judges and of the last days. People will be lovers of their own selves at the expense of self-sacrificing, of serving and loving others. So we finish this story with the Levite, Jonathan, the one from Bethlehem, who helps by scratching the surface, reveal the true motive of Micah. Now the Levites, of course, were the tribe that descended from Levi. And the priests were a group of qualified men from within that tribe who had the responsibility over all aspects of tabernacle worship. They were involved in the most sacred tasks. All priests were to be Levites according to the law, but just because you were a Levite didn't mean you could be a priest. Now the Levites had specific jobs. They were musicians, they were gatekeepers, guardians, they were temple officials, judges and craftsmen. But in particular we're told that they were responsible for packing up the tabernacle when it was on the move and transporting and then reconstructing it. But for the most sacred tasks, for sacrifices, well, they were reserved specifically for the descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother. So it would seem that this young, ambitious Jonathan was not content with being God's bellhop. Typically, with everyone doing that which was right in their own eyes, he desired more and he was seeking his fortune. He was looking for a place to make his mark. He wasn't content with hall cleaning, he wasn't content with setting up, he wasn't content with suppers and flowers. And even though he could have chosen from 48 Levitical cities, some of which he had visited, we learn that from the Danites' response to him in the following chapter, he wanted something better. And he arrives at Micah's house. Not Micah-U, but Micah's house. It's so random, isn't it? It's just such a fluke. It's so spontaneous. It just arrives at Micah's. Well, I think by now news had spread about what an amazing place it was to worship. Let's go to Micah's. And Micah, of course, thinks this is all providential. He thinks, oh, God's in control here because, well, I think I've got me a priest. And Jonathan is completely hypnotised by this amazing opulence, this religious glamour, and he's hooked. So verse 10 tells us that Micah makes him the offer of a lifetime. Be my priest. So the advantage for Micah is that he's going to legitimise his shrine with this officially recognised priest. He offers the deal. Jonathan doesn't even pass the contract through his lawyer. He cannot wait to sign up. Be my priest. and this official priest lends Micah's enterprise a whole pile of gravitas. So Micah's paying conditions included a wardrobe. But according to the King James margin, it wasn't just one wardrobe, it was two. And Jonathan couldn't get to the tailors quick enough to get his formal frocks, replete with the trinkets and robes. They'd create some nice rabbit fur trim for the collars, ecclesiastical turbans, just to give it that sense of religious service. But he had a double suit, so he had the religious wear and then he had his casual everyday wear supplied. Micah throws an elaborate celebration, consecrates Jonathan to become the priest of the Mount Ephraim diocese. Micah was getting quite good at this ordination business. He'd done it a few times now. The neighbours were there and Mummy was there in the front row, proud as punch. Jonathan takes up residence and becomes one of the family as well. We read that in verse 11. And the Levite was content to dwell with this man, and the young man was unto him as one of his sons. So we'll conclude with verse 13, which really gives us a true insight into this grubby little cesspool of self-interest. Then says Micah, "Now I know that the Lord will do me good, seeing I have a Levite to be my priest." So each person in this story is guilty of terrible sin. But the Levite was supposed to have known the word of God. So sometimes Levites were called the teaching priests because it was their responsibility to have their head in their Bibles, read it and understand it. He was ambitious, he was immature, and he was vibing his age. So here's a lesson and a warning for young people. Sin is exceedingly sinful. Every age has its unique challenges. Yours is device addiction, which leads to depression, chronic depression. And something else which I've been thinking about is the challenge of this woke view that mums make better dads than dads. And that's because everyone is doing that which is right in their own eyes. What we are observing right now is not the elevation of women, but the disrespect of women, the disrespect of children, and the disrespect of men. And this is all really confusing. But ultimately what's happening, subtly, is the God-supplied and God-endorsed family unit is being constantly undermined. So we might remember Lukey J's discussion at our ecclesial camp, and what he highlighted was this normalisation of single-sex family units. Because we see it everywhere, in the news, in TV shows, in children's books, it's normal. And so because we see it as being normal, it's hard to resist and it's hard to fight against. And it's certainly hard to have a conscience about. But the story of Jonathan teaches us that under God's rules, not everyone is equal. Levites were priests, but only if they met certain criteria, primarily being in Aaron's line. But Numbers chapter 6 and verse 2 teaches us something else that's really important. And that is, other tribes could devote themselves to God and they could swear to become a Nazarite. What did that mean? Well, it meant in the Old Testament, you could, whether you were bond or free, male or female, separate yourselves to God. And you could do that for a time. In fact, you could devote your life to God for as long as you like, men and women. But you just couldn't be a priest. So Jonathan secures his financial future by compromising God's principles. Micah's confidence in verse 13 was as false as his scam consecrations. They were both based on superstition, not on a love of God. proving that we can be utterly sincere and entirely wrong. I sincerely believe I could swim the Pacific Ocean. I'd be wrong. So from all appearances, this religion looked right, it felt good, and it was popular. The Levite's elevation to priesthood, thought Micah, washed him of some of his own personal responsibilities. Because it was Micah's priest, he's become my priest. So the priest can maintain my relationship with God, the priest can pray for me, the priest can read, the priest can prepare an exhort, the priest can possibly set up the hall, do the suppers and the flowers. Someone else can do the grind. But in the end, our relationship with God, like our relationship with people, correlates precisely to the amount of time that we dedicate towards it, to the amount of time we spend nurturing it. And so these emblems remind us of something that's really quite critical and important. What about when we don't know what to say? See, there are times when the prayers of others do change the course of our life, they do change the course of history, and they can change the course of our health. And we have a high priest. Our high priest isn't after the order of Aaron or Moses, but after the order of Melchizedek. Jesus is not untouched by our struggles. So unlike Micah, who sort of wanted to abdicate and sort of pass responsibility onto someone else for his relationship with God, what Jesus does is enhance our relationship with God. In fact, we have no relationship with God without the Lord Jesus Christ. And he hears our prayers, even when we don't know what to say. Even when we just can't find the words. But we don't give up. We cannot compromise, and we cannot stop believing. We can't go our own way, and we can't do that to our children. How did things work out for Micah? Quite well for a while, until the tribe of Dan arrived. So we read in verse 16 of Judges 18, there were 600 men appointed with their weapons of war, and they were the children of Dan, and they stood by the entering of the gate. Whose gate? Micah's gate. It was the gate to his temple, which was now more than a small shrine. It was a very large compound. And Micah says to them, in verse 18 at the end there, well, what do you think you're doing here? And they say to him, shh, hold your peace, old man. Lay thine hand upon thy mouth and go with us. And be a father to us and a priest. So, we're at Micah's place, but they're interrupted by Jonathan. Jonathan hears the ruckus because the Danites have gone in to steal all of Micah's stuff. What are you doing here? You can't be here. Just calm down. Calm down, Jonathan. We've got a job offer for you that you won't be able to refuse. What was the job offer? It was to be the priest, not of one man, but at the end of verse 19, why don't you become the priest unto a tribe and a family in Israel? And Jonathan's heart just was full in verse 20. The priest's heart was glad. So instead of the soldiers going in and stealing the stuff, Jonathan took the ephod and the teraphim and the graven of an image and went in the midst of the people. So they turned and departed and put the little ones and the cattle in the carriage before him. So he's jumped at the chance, hasn't he? And then he's pinched all of this gear. Micah goes running after them, but to no avail, he's sent on his way. And in verse 30 we read, and the children of Dan set up the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Manasseh, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of Dan until the day of the captivity of the land. So this tells us that Jonathan was actually the name of this freelancing Levite. And he was Moses' grandson. So here is a bit of insight into the hearts of the self-interested and ambitious. The offer of more power, more money, more prestige, more influence tickled his inflated ego, and he couldn't get his hands on Micah's religious icons quick enough. He deserts his posts with his robes and his turban and his fluffy collars without so much as a thank you, mother, for the rabbits.